This CLE course is based on the appellate decisions, New York State appellate decisions, released in December of 2019, dealing with criminal law. The summaries of these decisions were first published on the New York Appellate Digest website in December 2019, and they've been compiled into an update pamphlet. And the December 2019 criminal law update pamphlet serves as the written materials for this CLE, and the page references are to that pamphlet. The first case is People v. McGee on page 6. It deals with the failure to inform the defense about an eyewitness, a Brady violation. First Department granted defendant's motion to vacate his conviction and ordered a new trial, based upon the people's failure to notify the defense of a second eyewitness to the shooting. It was a Brady violation. The court wrote, several months after the trial concluded, the assistant district attorney who tried the case received an interoffice email attaching a report from a detective who had interviewed an eyewitness to the shooting. The ADA and another prosecutor had themselves interviewed the witness before the trial, having learned that a man who had been arrested for a drug sale near the polo grounds told a detective that he had seen the Phillips shooting. The prosecutor spoke to the eyewitness in the detective's presence, and no one took notes. Both prosecutors recalled only that the witness said he saw a man in brown clothes go down a 110-step staircase, shoot Phillips, and go back up the steps. The ADA concluded that the statement was cumulative and did not disclose it to the defense. However, after receiving the email, he notified defendant's trial counsel about the witness and attached a report, which he stated he had not known had ever been created. Defendant's trial lawyer submitted an affirmation in which he explained how timely disclosure of the information would have affected his preparation of the defense, including a misidentification defense. His investigator also submitted an affidavit in which he stated that timely disclosure would have been valuable because the statement contains several strong leads. So again, that failure to alert the defense to the existence of a second eyewitness required a new trial. Next is People v. Gillette, which is on pages 7 and 8. It's a constructive possession case. Third Department, reversing defendant's convictions relating to his presence in an apartment where methamphetamine was being produced, determined the evidence did not support the defendant's constructive possession of the relevant contraband in the apartment. The court wrote, viewed in the light most favorable to the people, the evidence could reasonably support the conclusion that defendant had dominion and control over two regions, batteries and salt. Those the batteries and salt were inside the defendant's backpack. However, considering the witness testimony and the photographs demonstrating the extremely cluttered state of the living room and apartment overall, the evidence was legally insufficient to establish that defendant had the ability and intent to exercise dominion and control over any of the items of lab equipment seized from the apartment. So the regions found in the defendant's backpack were possessed by him, but the evidence was insufficient to support that he constructively possessed the lab equipment that was in the apartment where he was present. Next is People v. Ruffin, which is on page 8. It has to do with courtroom closure. First Department, ordering a new trial, held the defendant's family members should not have been excluded from the courtroom during the undercover officer's testimony. The court said, the people failed to show specifically that defendant's family posed a threat to the undercover officer's safety. The people acknowledged that a harmless error, lack of prejudice analysis does not apply to courtroom closure errors. So because there was no specific proof, the family posed a danger to the undercover officer, a new trial was required because there's no harmless error analysis in this context. Next is People v. Knowles on page 9. It has to do with the definition of a dangerous instrument, in this case a box cutter. First Department reversing defendant's criminal possession of a weapon conviction, held the proof that defendant simply possessed a box cutter was not enough. The court said, as the jury was charged, a dangerous instrument is any instrument, article, or substance which, under the circumstances in which it is used, attempted to be used, or threatened to be used, is readily capable of causing death or other serious physical injury. An object becomes a dangerous instrument when it is used in a manner which renders it readily capable of causing serious physical injury. Here, there was no proof that defendant used the box cutter, attempted to use it, or threatened to use it, as required under the plain terms of the statute, in order for it to be a dangerous instrument. Next is People versus Udeki, which is on page 10. It's a Court of Appeals case. It's a brief memorandum decision. Court of Appeals, over an extensive dissenting opinion, held the accusatory instrument accusing defendant of criminal contempt was sufficient and defendant's guilty plea was voluntary. During the plea colloquy, defendant, a non-citizen, was told he did not have the right to a jury trial on the deportation-eligible B misdemeanor. While the defendant's leave application to the Court of Appeals was pending, the Court of Appeals decided People v. Suazo at 32 New York 3rd 491, which afforded persons in defendant's position the right to a jury trial. So the Court of Appeals refused to apply that Court of Appeals decision retroactively to this case. Next is People v. Williams on page 11. It's another case that deals with informing a defendant about the deportation consequences of a guilty plea. Second Department, over a concurrence, rejected defendant's argument that his plea was involuntary because he was not informed he would be deported as a consequence of the plea. There was no indication in the record that plaintiff was not a U.S. citizen. Defendant told the court he was a citizen, and the pre-sentence report indicated defendant was a naturalized U.S. citizen. However, the Second Department took the opportunity to instruct the courts how the citizenship issue should be handled. So the court wrote, "A trial court should not ask a defendant whether he or she is a United States citizen and decide whether to advise the defendant of the plea's deportation consequence based upon the defendant's answer. Instead, a trial court should advise all defendants pleading guilty to felonies that if they are not United States citizens, their felony guilty plea may expose them to deportation." Next is the People v. Lewis, which is on page 12. It's a prosecutorial misconduct case dealing with showing the jury photographs that were irrelevant to the issues at trial. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction and ordering a new trial, held the photographs of the complainant's genitals and anus were irrelevant and should not have been admitted in this sex offense case. The court said, "Complainant's pediatrician, who was called as a witness by the prosecutor, testified that there were no injuries to the complainant's genitals or anus, and that she did not expect to see any injury based upon the complainant's report. The error was then compounded when the prosecutor argued in summation that the complainant had to get on a table, open up her legs, and have her genitals photographed to be shown to 15 strangers. What did she gain out of this?" the prosecutor asked. "Nothing," the prosecutor said. "The improper admission of the photographs cannot be deemed harmless under the circumstances of this case." Next is People v. Dunbar on page 13. It's a case that deals with the criteria for reopening a suppression hearing. The Second Department, remitting the matter for a reopened suppression hearing, held the hearing was warranted by new information that the stop of defendant's vehicle may have been based on information from an anonymous source. The defendant had already been convicted of attempted robbery twice after a reversal. The court said, "Criminal Procedure Law Section 71040, Subdivision 4, permits a court to reopen a suppression hearing if additional pertinent facts have been discovered, which the defendant could not have discovered with reasonable diligence before the determination of the original suppression motion. The additional facts discovered need not necessarily be outcome determinative or essential. Instead, they must be pertinent in that they would materially affect or have affected the earlier suppression ruling. Here, the revelation that the livery car description may have come from an anonymous bystander who interjected while translating between the complainant and the sergeant at the scene was previously unknown, and because the sergeant did not previously testify in the case, could not have been discovered with due diligence by the defendant. Next is People v. Herring on page 14. It's another case that deals with the submission of evidence. Second Department held that county court should not have held defendant violated the probation condition prohibiting him from committing a new crime because the evidence of the new crime was not presented to the court until after the close of the evidence in the hearing. The court said, while the court would have been permitted to take judicial notice of the defendant's subsequent indictment for attempted murder, that evidence was presented after the close of evidence at the revocation of probation hearing. The defendant had no opportunity to be heard regarding the indictment and related documents relied on by the court. Accordingly, the court should not have found that the defendant violated the condition of his probation based upon the commission of a new crime. Next, People v. Cook on pages 14 and 15. Another evidence-related case involving a suppression hearing. This is out of the Court of Appeals. In a full-fledged opinion by Judge Garcia over a two-judge dissenting opinion, the court held that the suppression court did not abuse its discretion by allowing the people to reopen the suppression hearing to present another witness after the people had rested. The court subsequently denied the motion to suppress. The Court of Appeals framed the issue around the, quote, one full opportunity, end quote, rule, which precludes reopening a hearing in other contexts, and decided not to extend that one full opportunity rule to the pre-ruling stage of a suppression hearing. The court wrote, in Havelka, which is 45 New York 2nd, 636, we applied the one full opportunity rule to a holding by an appellate court overturning the decision of a suppression court. In Kevin W., 22 New York 3rd, 287, we applied the same rule to the suppression court's decision to reopen the hearing after its ruling on the merits of the motion. Defendant now asks us to apply the rule at a point still earlier in the process, similarly restricting the suppression court's discretion before any decision is made. This we decline to do. A basic concern underlying both Havelka and Kevin W. is finality, described as the haunting specter of renewed proceedings after the defendant initially has prevailed. We explained in Havelka that allowing the people to present additional evidence at a new hearing would render success at the original suppression hearing nearly meaningless. The people, we said, should not get a second chance to succeed where once they tried and failed. However, that concern is absent where no decision on the motion has been rendered by the hearing court. No victory will be rendered nearly meaningless. The second issue of concern weighing in favor of the one full opportunity rule, the risk of improperly tailored testimony at the reopened proceedings, is significantly lower where the people do not have a formal decision from either an appellate court or the hearing court. Next is McCray on pages 15 and 16. It has to do with the proper use of an application for a writ of habeas corpus. Third Department held that petitioner's application for a writ of habeas corpus was properly denied because the issues could have been raised in a direct appeal or in a criminal procedure law section 440 motion to vacate the conviction. The court said habeas corpus is not the appropriate remedy for raising claims that could have been raised on direct appeal or in the context of a 440 motion, even if they are jurisdictional in nature. Petitioner's contentions regarding his sentences, including their legality and whether they merged under Penal Law Section 70.35, could have been raised on direct appeal or in a 440 motion. Next is People v. Lawhorn on page 16. It has to do with a judge negotiating a guilty plea for a witness at trial. Fourth Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held the trial judge should not have negotiated a plea deal with a co-defendant in exchange for testimony against the defendant. The court said the court committed reversible error when it negotiated and entered into a plea agreement with a co-defendant, requiring that individual to testify against defendant in exchange for a more favorable sentence. Here, by assuming the function of an interested party and deviating from its own role as a neutral arbiter, the trial court denied defendant his due process right to a fair trial in a fair tribunal. Next is People versus Patterson on pages 16 and 17. It has to do with handling a for-cause challenge to a juror, Court of Appeals case. The Court of Appeals, in a brief memorandum over a three-judge partial dissent, held the trial court properly handled a for-cause challenge to a prospective juror. The court said when defense counsel directly asked the prospective juror, "If you don't hear from defendant, you don't hear him speak, are you going to hold that against him?" She responded, "I don't believe that I would." This response directly refuted any notion that the prospective juror would hold defendant's failure to testify against him. That is, that she would be biased in rendering a decision. Viewing this statement in totality and in context, the exchange did not, in the first instance, demonstrate pre-existing opinions that might indicate bias. Thus, the trial court was not required to inquire further to obtain an unequivocal assurance that the juror could be fair and impartial. Again, the juror in that case was asked if she would hold it against the defendant if he didn't testify, and she said, "I don't believe that I would." Next is People versus Camacho on page 17 and 18. It's an interesting case involving ineffective assistance and a couple of evidentiary issues. First Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held 1. Defense counsel was ineffective for failing to request the jury be charged with a lesser-included offense of petit larceny in this robbery case involving the theft of cell phones. And 2. The value of the cell phones should not have been added together because there was no proof the phones were owned by the same owner. The court wrote, "It was alleged defendant forcibly stole a cell phone in that his showing of a knife to the store employee constituted a threat of force and was perceived by the employee as a threat. While the defense conceded that defendant stole a cell phone, it denied any force was used. Nevertheless, at the charge conference prior to jury deliberations, defense counsel failed to ask for submission of the charge of petit larceny. Since the existing record clearly establishes that this was a mistake rather than a strategic decision, no 440 motion is necessary. When counsel asked for submission of the lesser included offense in the midst of jury deliberations, he expressly admitted that he had been remiss in not making a timely request." And the court went on, "Defendant is also entitled to dismissal of the grand larceny charge, which was based upon the improper aggregation of the value of cell phones taken from two separate stores on two different days. The people failed to prove that the stores and the phones located in them had the same owner for the purpose of aggregating multiple thefts." So the unusual aspect of this case is the defense attorneys admitting that he made a mistake in failing to ask for a specific jury instruction, which was an admission of ineffective assistance, and the issue could be raised on direct appeal. There was no need to make a 440 motion. Next is People versus Morena on page 18, a Court of Appeals case that deals with a judge changing his or her mind about a jury instruction. The Court of Appeals, in a full-fledged opinion by Judge Stein, held that in the two cases before the court, the trial court's reversing after summation its pre-summation position on a jury instruction was error, but in both cases it was harmless error. In Marina, the judge, after agreeing to do so before summation, failed to charge the jury that defendant could not be convicted of manslaughter unless the jury found the fatal injury was caused by a box cutter or a knife. And in Altamirano, after denying the defense request for a jury charge on the innocent possession of a weapon prior to summation, the judge so charged the jury after summation. So both of those were errors, the court went on. A trial court's error in reversing a prior charging decision after summations have been completed is subject to harmless error analysis. We conclude that the evidence of guilt in both of the instant cases was overwhelming. Thus, whether the error was harmless turns on the question of whether defendants were prejudiced. And again, they found no prejudice there. Next is People v. Burgess. On page 19, it has to do with the allowed cross-examination of a police officer about a civil lawsuit. First Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held the hearing and trial courts should have allowed cross-examination of a police officer about a lawsuit naming the officer. The court said, both the hearing and trial courts erred in denying defendant's request to cross-examine a police officer regarding allegations of misconduct in a civil lawsuit in which it was claimed, among other things, that this particular officer arrested the plaintiff without suspicion of criminality and lodged false charges against him. The civil complaint contained specific allegations of falsification by this officer that bore on his credibility at both the hearing and the trial. At each proceeding, this officer was the only witness for the people. Next is People v. Z on pages 19 and 20. It deals with a defendant who wishes to represent himself and the required inquiry by the trial judge. First Department, reversing defendant's conviction over a dissent, held defendant's request to represent himself should not have been granted without further inquiry into defendant's mental health. The First Department found that the results of defendant's Article 730 competency exams, finding that defendant may have been delusional, constituted red flags that warranted further inquiry before allowing defendant to represent himself. The court wrote, defendant appeared for trial before a justice who was presiding over the case for the first time. Defense counsel informed the court that defendant wished to proceed pro se. Neither defense counsel nor the prosecution made the court aware of defendant's CPL Article 730 exams or the potential for him to be experiencing delusional thoughts. Although the trial court conducted an extensive colloquy with defendant regarding the waiver of his right to counsel, at no point did the court inquire into defendant's mental health. We find that notwithstanding other aspects of the record supporting defendant's capacity, the information in the CPL Article 730 reports indicating a potential for delusional thought was a red flag that required a particularized assessment of defendant's mental capacity before resolving his request to proceed pro se. Next, People v. Day on page 20, prosecutorial misconduct case. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held that the prosecutor's untrue claim made in summation and immediately objected to that defendant's DNA was found on the weapon used to shoot the victim required a new trial. Next is People v. Dawson. On page 21, another prosecutorial misconduct case, Second Department ordering a new trial, held prosecutorial misconduct deprived the defendant of a fair trial. The court wrote, during summation, the prosecutor repeatedly engaged in improper conduct. For instance, the prosecutor denigrated the defense and disparaged the defendant, referring to his self-defense claim as ridiculous, insulting, and ludicrous, and informing the jury that the defendant would tell you anything in an effort to sell you a story. The prosecutor described the defendant as a hothead and a punk who could not take a beating like a man. Moreover, the prosecutor impinged on the defendant's right to remain silent before arrest by arguing that he could not have acted in self-defense during the altercation because he didn't call the 911 emergency number. Further, the prosecutor improperly invoked the jury's sympathy for the complainant, vouched for the complainant's credibility, and interjected her own sense of moral retribution with respect to the complainant's entitlement to use physical force against the defendant, while misleading the jury as to the law on justification. Next, on pages 21 and 22, is Briest versus Haggis. It's not a criminal case. It deals with a lawsuit under New York City's Victims of Gender-Motivated Violence Protection Law. First Department, in a full opinion by Justice Moulton over a concurring opinion, held that plaintiff's complaint alleging rape and sexual assault stated a valid cause of action under New York City's Victims of Gender-Motivated Violence Protection Law. The acronym is VGM. The central question on appeal was the meaning of the term animus. Supreme Court held that allegations defendant had sexually assaulted other women were properly included in the complaint to demonstrate animus. The First Department held plaintiff's allegations of rape and assault without allegations involving other women were sufficient. The court said, rape and sexual assault are, by definition, actions taken against the victim without the victim's consent. Without consent, sexual acts such as those alleged in the complaint are a violation of the victim's bodily autonomy and an expression of the perpetrator's contempt for that autonomy. Coerced sexual activity is dehumanizing and fear-inducing. Malice or ill will based on gender is apparent from the alleged commission of the act itself. Animus inheres where consent is absent. Next is People v. Thompson on pages 22 and 23. It has to do with the overbreadth of a search warrant for a cell phone. The First Department, vacating defendant's guilty plea, held that the search warrant issued for defendant's cell phone was overly broad and that it authorized a search going back 8 months before the conduct alleged in the warrant. The court said, the search warrant for defendant's phones was overbroad. The application alleged that on September 1, 2016, defendant sent texts to a 13-year-old making indecent proposals and called her on the same day. The warrant authorized examination of defendant's internet usage from January 1 to September 13, 2016, and also authorized, without a time limitation, examination of essentially all the other data on defendant's phones. This failed to satisfy the particularity requirement of both the Fourth Amendment and Article 1, Section 12 of New York's Constitution. The pivotal question here is whether there was probable cause that evidence of the crime specified in the warrant would be found in the broad area specified. Notably, the warrant application alleged two discrete crimes and specified conduct that began on September 1, 2016, and, as far as the available information indicated, occurred entirely on that date. While it was, of course, possible that defendant's phone contained evidence of the specified offenses that predated September 1, there were no specific allegations to that effect. The information available to the warrant-issuing court did not support a reasonable belief that evidence of the crime specified in the warrant would be found in all of the locations within defendant's cell phone to which the warrant authorized access, for example, in defendant's browsing history 6 or 7 months before September 1, 2016, or in his emails, the examination of which was authorized without any time restriction. Next is People v. Melamed on pages 23 and 24. It's another search warrant case involving an overly broad warrant. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court over a dissent, held the search warrant for business computers, computer files, and documents amounted to a general warrant, and the items seized should have been suppressed. The warrant was procured by the Office of Attorney General and targeted two realty companies, which were alleged to have involvement in the illegal construction and demolition of rent-stabilized buildings. The court said, the search warrant permitted the Attorney General to search and seize broad categories of items relating to 1578 Union Street Realty Corporation, Dream Home Realty, and a number of other businesses allegedly controlled by the defendant through which he had conducted real estate transactions. The items permitted to be searched and seized included corporate documents, employment records, employee lists, and employment contracts, all calendar books, appointment books, and address books, all computers, computer hard drives, and computer files stored on other media, and all bank, tax, and financial records. The warrant did not name or specify any particular crime or offense to which the search was related and did not incorporate the affidavit by reference. Other than a date restriction covering a period of approximately 5 years, the warrant permitted the Office of Attorney General to search and seize all computers, hard drives, and computer files stored on other devices without any guidelines, parameters, or constraints on the type of items to be viewed and seized. As has been observed by federal courts, where the property to be searched is computer files, the particularity requirement assumes even greater importance, since the potential for privacy violations occasioned by an unbridled exploratory search of such files is enormous. Additionally, as to paper documents, the warrant merely identified generic classes of items, effectively permitting the Office of Attorney General to search and seize virtually all conceivable documents that would be created in the course of operating a business. Next is People v. Porter on page 24. It basically deals with the requirements for an appeal of an adjudication of a Sex Offender Registration Act assessment. The Third Department dismissed the appeal of County Court's SORA risk assessment because County Court did not issue an appealable order. The court wrote, "The Sex Offender Registration Act requires that County Court must render an order setting forth its determinations and the findings of fact and conclusions of law on which the determinations are based. That written order must then be entered and filed in the office of the clerk of the court where the action is triable." And it cites CPLR 2220, Subdivision A. Here, County Court issued a written decision which was subsequently entered and filed. However, the decision contains no language indicating that it is an order or judgment, and it does not appear that a written order was entered and filed. The risk assessment instrument does not contain so ordered language so that it may constitute an appealable order. Accordingly, this appeal is not properly before this court and must be dismissed. Next is People v. Davis on pages 25 and 26, another Sex Offender Registration Act case, Second Department, modifying the SORA court in a comprehensive, full-fledged opinion by Justice Austin, held defendant sex offender was entitled to a downward modification of his risk assessment from level 3 to level 1. The court wrote, "The defendant's submissions demonstrated that through his long-term sobriety, strong family support, faith-based and law-abiding lifestyle, continuous employment despite his numerous physical disabilities and age, his risk of reoffending is so diminished that a further reduction from his current risk level 2 to risk level 1 is appropriate. If a defendant served his or her sentence, rehabilitated himself or herself, and demonstrated no actual likelihood of reoffending, a reduction to a level 1 classification from a level 3 classification should be a possibility. Did the defendant establish by clear and convincing evidence that the risk he poses to the community as a convicted sex offender warrants a downward modification to level 1? We answer that question in the affirmative. To hold otherwise ignores the sincere positive strides the defendant has made to be a productive, positive member of society. By using the disturbing nature of one's crime as the tipping point in the analysis of a petition such as the one before this court comes dangerously close to saying, if not holding, that once one has committed a sex crime and has been designated a sex offender level, there is no way he or she can ever be rehabilitated to a legally sufficient extent to warrant a downward modification to the lowest level of supervision. If that were so, then the cited portions of the Guidelines and Correction Law, Section 168, which allow annual reevaluation of defendant's risk level after it has been initially established, would be rendered without meaning and illusory. Next is People v. Lewis on page 26, another Sex Offender Registration Act case. Second Department held defendant's conviction of attempted endangering the welfare of a child did not meet the criteria for assessing 30 points under risk factor 9, and therefore defendant should have been assessed at a presumptive level 1. The people argued that had the defendant been assessed at a presumptive level 1, they would have sought an upward departure based on aggravating factors. The matter was remitted for a new determination. So once the mistake in assessing 30 points for attempted endangering the welfare of a child was noted, the people argued that had they known of that mistake, they would have sought an upward departure, and the second department gave the people the chance to do that, to argue for an upward departure. Next is People versus Jarama, which is on page 27, another sex offender registration act case. Second department, reducing defendant's risk assessment to level 1, held the proof of multiple instances of sexual conduct was insufficient. The court wrote, the people failed to meet their burden of proof with respect to risk factor 4, although the people submitted evidence in the form of the defendant's statements that he engaged in sexual contact with the victim on 3 or 4 occasions. They failed to submit any evidence as to when these instances of sexual contact occurred relative to one another, so as to demonstrate that such instances were separated in time by at least 24 hours, as the people claimed. Accordingly, the Supreme Court should not have assessed 20 points under risk factor 4. Next is People versus Brown on pages 27 and 28, another Sex Offender Registration Act case. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant should not have been assessed 15 points for his history of drug and alcohol abuse. The evidence of drug use was remote in time, and drug use was not an aspect of the offense. Next is People versus Ramos on page 28, another Sex Offender Registration Act case. Fourth Department, vacating the risk level determination, held the proof of that defendant was a sex offender was insufficient. The documents relating to a conviction in Puerto Rico were in Spanish and were not translated. The court said, we agree with defendant that in making its determination that defendant is a sex offender, the board erred in relying on documents in Spanish that were not accompanied by an English translation, citing CPLR 2101 subdivision B. Next is People versus Britt on pages 29 and 30, a Court of Appeals case dealing with street stops. Court of Appeals, in a full-fledged opinion by Judge Fahey, over an extensive two-judge dissent, held defendant was properly pursued and detained after a police officer saw him on the street drinking from a container inside a paper bag and then saw him run inside a nearby building as the officer approached. The court further determined the intent to defraud could be inferred from the defendant's possession of counterfeit bills. The defendant had both counterfeit and real money on his person kept separately. And I'll just read from the dissent because it outlines the issues. This is from the dissent. The majority lauds the hot pursuit and forcible detention of Clinton Britt, a man drinking a lime drink wrapped in a brown paper bag in Times Square shortly before midnight, and his subsequent conviction for intending to spend counterfeit money absent any indication that he attempted or planned to use it, simply because it was found rubber-banded separately from his real money when he was searched upon arrest. Both are mistakes. Again, this is the dissent. The first, let's chase and physically detain people drinking from unseen containers in brown paper bags, is perhaps understandable because of the tremendous difficulty inherent in the misapplication of our DeBoer test in many real-world situations. The sad consequence of that mistake is a regression from the legislative and prosecutorial progress, eschewing policing based on stereotypes, returning us to the world of broken windows, where police pursue quality of life violations that disproportionately affect the poor, not merely those committing the infractions, but their families, neighbors, and communities. Again, this is from the dissent. going on with the dissent. The second, let's equate the separation of real from counterfeit money with the intent to defraud, is inexplicable. It overturns our clear holding in People v. Bailey, 13 New York 3rd, 67, by contravening the most fundamental proposition of evidence. A fact is not evidence unless it makes the disputed issue more likely to be true than it otherwise would be. Put simply, if you knew you had counterfeit money on your person and did not want to use it, you would keep it separate from your real money. That defendant kept his real and fake money separate says nothing about his intent to use it to defraud, deceive, or injure anyone, which is a statutory requirement under Penal Law Section 170.30. And again, the pursuit of a man seen drinking from a something in a brown paper bag and then running into a nearby building was upheld by the majority, and the criticism of that decision, which I just read to you, is from the dissent. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation. The verification code for this December 2019 criminal law update CLE is paper bag. Again, the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this December 2019 criminal law update CLE is paper bag. And the final case is People v. Stover on page 30. It has to do with extraneous information on a verdict sheet. The Third Department held, although it was error to include extraneous information on the verdict sheet, that being that the defendant had authorized the verdict sheet, that error was harmless. The court wrote, the Court of Appeals has held that it is reversible error, not subject to harmless error analysis, to provide a jury in a criminal case with a verdict sheet that contains annotations not authorized by Criminal Procedure Law Section 31020, Subdivision 2. Moreover, the basic principle is that nothing of substance can be included that the statute does not authorize. The extraneous statement was not part of the questions posed to the jury. Rather, it was at the end of the verdict sheet. It didn't change any of the questions to the jury. We find that the submission to the jury of the verdict sheet with the statement asserting that defendant authorized it without his signature was not reversible error because the extraneous statement gave no substantive information to the jury about the case and merely indicated that defendant saw the verdict sheet, was aware of his charges, and was represented by an attorney. So that concludes this December 2019 criminal law update CLE.